Is it possible to have truths without truth, values without value, or purposes without purpose? Stay tuned. Renewing Your Mind, Weekend Edition, is next. Welcome to this weekend broadcast of Renewing Your Mind with Dr. R.C. Sproul. Dr. Sproul is a minister of preaching and teaching at St. Andrew's Chapel in Sanford, Florida. So, is it possible to have truths without truth? If so, then how can we scientifically test the validity of that particular truth? Welcome to the confusing world of modern philosophy. Or should we say, welcome home? For these ideas are not locked up in ivory towers where philosophers ponder life's deep questions. They affect our everyday lives. Philosophies such as positivism, pragmatism, pluralism, and relativism have been let loose to roam the halls of our schools, workplaces, and yes, even our churches. So, how do we deal with them? The first thing we must do is identify them. Dr. Sproul will help us do that today on Renewing Your Mind as we conclude our series on philosophy. Now, here's Dr. Sproul with today's lecture, Modern Philosophers.
In our last session, we talked about Sartre's concept of existential self-awareness, and that's the kind of thing I'm experiencing right now for a couple of reasons. One is that because I have a sore throat, and they caught me with these cameras just as I was finishing a throat lozenge. And I'm trying to emulate Demosthenes, like speaking with stones in my mouth. But the second reason why I feel this existential self-awareness is that we've come now to the end of this series. And today's message will be the last in this series of the consequences of ideas. And what I want to do today, rather than to go into detail into several philosophers or schools of thought that characterize the day in which we live now, I want to give a sweeping, broad picture of the climate of philosophical inquiry at the end of the 20th century. There are many schools of thought competing for acceptance in our day, but they have several things in common, and all of them, in one sense, can be traced back to a movement that was a post-Kantian movement of the 19th century, introduced by a philosopher by the name of Auguste Comte, and it was the school known as positivism. And positivism, as it was set forth by Comte, was an attempt, as Marx had given us and others, to produce a kind of philosophy of history, in which he said, in the development, the evolutionary progress of civilization and of Western humanity, that people have gone through three stages of cultural development and intellectual development that correspond to stages in human biological development. And in his analysis, he said the first stage of Western culture is the stage of its infancy, where here the dominant themes of inquiry were those associated with religion, which, according to Comte, in the final analysis, is nothing more, nothing less than an exercise in mythology. It is an infantile response to our world and life to try to make sense of it by an appeal to some kind of religion. But then as people began to grow up and as civilization began to mature, at least reaching its adolescence stage, then the dominant controlling factor to define life and the world was found in the abstract realm of philosophy. But now, according to Comte, at the end of the 19th century and going into the 20th century, mankind has finally come of age, where we've moved beyond the infantile and beyond the adolescent to the adult stage of intellectual inquiry that is dominated now not by religion or philosophy, but by science. It's a new form of empiricism. And so positivism, as it moved into the 20th century, and as was developed particularly by British thinkers such as A.J. Eyre and Anthony Flew, developed the concept of a scientific approach to reality by which they came to the conclusion that no propositions are meaningful unless they can be verified empirically. Now, this is an idea drawn from science, wherein the scientific inquiry and the enterprise, the data that is collected and observed, have to be tested not by formal principles or theorems, but in the final analysis, their accuracy and truth value can only be determined by empirical measurement or verification. That is, if you can't see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, or so on, it isn't real. So that the real is only that which can be verified by the senses. Now, not only that, but the logical positivists developed their law of verification with respect to meaningful statements or propositions. And the law or principle of verification simply says, for any statement or proposition to be meaningful, it must be verified empirically. Now, this swept through the philosophical world in the earlier segments of the 20th century, and it produced in philosophy and in theology a serious crisis in language. In the 70s and 60s, we saw in the realm of theology the movement called theothanatology, or the death of God. And that whole movement, the death of God movement, was spawned by a crisis of skepticism about language. And that was related to the question whether any of our discussions about God can be deemed meaningful. Or is all religious language simply emotive? Emotive language is language that expresses feelings. And if we cannot verify empirically the propositions that we assert with respect to God, that He is eternal, that He is infinite, that He is omniscient, and all of these things, since we can't see Him, subject Him to the scrutiny of the microscope, or contain Him in a laboratory for experiments and tests and so on, then that means that any statements that we make about God cannot be verified. And if they cannot be verified, they cannot be laden with meaning other than emotive meaning. Which is to say that what the statements of theologians like myself are worth is this, that all they really teach is something about my feeling state, something about my emotions. They don't give us any information or communicate any objective truth about reality. And so this crisis of God talk burst onto the scene after the middle of the 20th century. Now, of course, to the great embarrassment of the founders of logical positivism, it wasn't too long before the philosophers who were critics of this system pointed out what should have been obvious to the founders of it, namely that their central thesis fell by virtue of its own weight. And in the critiques that were launched, they revealed that the emperor had no clothes. Because the problem with the law of verification, which states that the only statements that can be meaningful are those statements that can be verified empirically, that's the law. Well, that law, with its statement, cannot be verified empirically. And so, as I said, it falls of its own weight. And the verification principle itself fails to meet its own test. And if it fails to meet its own test, it would have to be seen as a meaningless statement. And if it's a meaningless statement, the whole system then obviously collapses. Now, even though the verification principle met a hasty demise in the intellectual world, some of the basic tenets of positivistic philosophy lingered on and maintained a strong impact on the culture in other ways, as it was linked to other philosophies and concepts. Again, the homegrown philosophy of America, the only philosophical movement that was born in the continental United States, and the philosophy that many people have said define American culture in the 20th century, is the philosophy of pragmatism, formulated by John Dewey and Charles Peirce. Pragmatism, in simple language, teaches that the good or the true is determined not by some metaphysical norm or standard. Which norms and standards, according to pragmatism, remain forever unknowable. Remember, this was a philosophy born on this side of the Kantian watershed, where the skepticism remains that we do not have any access to the realm of metaphysics, to the realm of being, that we are locked in to this side, to the realm of phenomena, to the realm of existence, to the realm of positive things. And for the positivist, for example, and its tie-in with pragmatism, the positivists would say, and did say, that there is no such thing as truth, only truths. There's no such thing as value, only values. There's no such thing as purpose, only purposes. Now that may sound crazy to you. How can there be truths unless there is some norm or standard by which you measure a statement to say that it is true? How can you have truths if there is no truth? How can you have purpose if you have no purpose? Well, let me say again, here the emphasis is on the particular rather than the universal, on existence rather than essence, on becoming rather than being. Let me illustrate it with my favorite illustration of what I experienced in this culture. What I went through, the trauma of sending our firstborn child, our daughter, off to school for the first time. She was going to kindergarten when she was 5 years old, and we lived in Boston. And I knew when she went out the door that I was now turning over much of her development and input of ideas to somebody outside the family. And so we enrolled her in the public school system in Boston. And we got a letter a couple weeks later where we were invited to come to a parent meeting at the school where the principal of the school was going to explain the philosophy of education and the whole design of the curriculum for the parents so that we would know what was going on. And so we went, and this man began his speech by saying that you parents, I know, are concerned about what your children are learning, particularly those in kindergarten and the earlier grades. Your children come home from school at the end of the day and you say to them, what did you do today? And they say, well, they played with puzzles or modeling clay. And you say, what is this? A sophisticated kind of babysitting. He said, I want you to understand that every single thing that is done during the course of a school day by these children has been carefully thought out and carefully, scientifically designed for a reason. In other words, he said, there's a purpose for everything that they do. He said, for example, from 9 o'clock till 9:17, the kids play with these puzzles. And he held up this puzzle. And he said, you may think that they're just having fun and games. He said, but these puzzles were specifically designed and developed by a team of neurosurgeons from Boston General Hospital with the specific purpose in mind in teaching children how to use their motor skills in the last three fingers of the left hand. And we gasped. And then he said, from 9:17 to 9:21, they use this modeling clay, and it has a purpose of developing this aspect of the child's motor skills and so on. And he went through every minute of the day and showed why every single aspect of the day was doing whatever it was it was doing. And at the end of his lecture, after this prodigious display of technical preparation, he smiled and said, are there any questions? And the immediate response of the audience was spontaneous laughter. Like, who in the world in their right mind is going to raise any questions? Well, I raised my hand. And I said, sir, I really appreciate this presentation, you've made your point that everything is done here is done for a purpose. But theoretically, you have an infinite number of individual purposes that you could choose to implement in the design of your educational curriculum. And obviously, along the way, you've had to make decisions and choices to include this aspect of learning in your curriculum instead of something else. And so you've told us all these specific purposes that you implement. I'd like you to tell me what the overarching purpose is that shapes your philosophical educational theory here, that becomes the norm for why you implement the specific particular purposes that you do during the day. I said, in other words, what kind of a child are you trying to produce and why? When I asked him that question, his immediate response was his face turned beet red and then ash white. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know. He said, nobody's ever asked me that question. And I looked at him and I said, thank you so much for your candor. I really appreciate your openness on this. I said, but your answer terrifies me. But that's where we are in the culture. That is the legacy of a positivistic approach to reality and truth. You have all these purposes, but no purpose. All kinds of particular meanings, but no meaning. No wonder Francis Schaeffer stuttered and raised questions about true truth in our day. Because that's the crisis in modern philosophy. The crisis is whether there is such a thing as truth. The pragmatist, building on this, says objective truth cannot be known. And you determine the true and the good and the purposive by one standard. Does it work? That's the philosophy of pragmatism, where truth and goodness are determined by what works. If you have a problem, you solve it now. If your workable solution creates two new problems, you solve those. And if those solutions create each two more exponentially, you just keep chasing them down and solve them one at a time. That's the American way. The difficult takes, we can do immediately. The impossible will take a little longer. But nevertheless, the American spirit is the spirit of pragmatism. We can make it work. The problem with this, however, of being practical or pragmatic, is how do you know if it works ultimately? Pragmatism is really not all that new. Pragmatism is concerned with short-term solutions and refuses to think subspecies aeternitatis from the perspective of the infinite. It came sharply under the critique of Jesus of Nazareth, who said, what profit a man if he gains the whole world and he loses his own soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? What Jesus was saying at that point is, if you wanted to work your life on the basis of what works, you better ask yourself what works ultimately. Because it may work well enough to gain you the whole world, but if it costs you your soul, it doesn't work. And it's not good, and it's not true. But that's part of the climate of our culture in terms of pragmatism. It has other things that go along with it, pluralism and relativism. Pluralism teaches that there is no such thing as, again, truth, only truths. And that disparate, contradictory truths may be embraced for the sake of public peace and fellowship. You have churches today who will give their ministers optional creeds to confess, even though they are antithetical to each other. They say the church is big enough to hold within it contradictory theologies because we embrace pluralism, variety. and the unum of the e pluribus is exited. It's e pluribus plurum now, instead of e pluribus unum. Once you step into pluralism, or its twin relativism. Finally, perhaps the most dominant school today in Western philosophy is called linguistic analysis, or the philosophy of language. Since the pursuit of metaphysical truth, and even epistemological truth, not to mention the philosophy of history, have been for the most part abandoned, what is left for students of philosophy and philosophers to do is to analyze how people speak and how we use language. One of the most important philosophers for this in the 20th century was Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said that the meaning of language is determined in the final analysis by customary usage. That is, words are not to be defined in the final analysis by their etymological derivations or their historic meanings, but rather simply how they are used. And so the task of the philosopher is to clarify and to enhance verbal communication. And this comes by an analysis of grammar, of syntax, of the structure of statements, determining what kinds of propositions are used in the interchange of ideas, and most specifically, honing in on the specific meaning of particular words. And here we are, almost back to square one, where we're examining the tools of knowledge and the tools of communication, having abandoned the pursuit of ultimate truth.
That was Dr. R.C. Sproul identifying the modern philosophies that have shaped our current culture. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, Weekend Edition. Praying for and supporting our pastors is of incalculable value in the life of the local church. In a day when pop psychology and anecdotal storytelling has replaced biblical exposition, we need more than ever pastors who are willing to feed the flock of God what they truly need, the Word of God. Indeed, there is a real famine in the pulpit today. Written to address this problem, Dr. Sproul and many other faithful preachers of the Word have teamed together to provide a resource for pastors who are seeking to remain faithful to their calling. The book, Feed My Sheep, A Passionate Plea for Preaching, reveals the biblical basis for preaching, sketches a way it ought to be practiced, and shows the many practical benefits that flow from strong pulpits. Here is encouragement for preachers and wise counsel for those who desire to sit under the ministry of the Word of God preached. Today, the book Feed My Sheep is available for a donation of any amount. This is a perfect gift for your pastor or anyone else preparing for the preaching ministry. So call now. Our toll-free number is 1-800-435-4343. Once again, that's 1-800-435-4343. Or you can go online to rymoffer.com. That's RYM as in renewing your mind, and the word offer.com. Again, that's RYMOFFER.com. Remember to please allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery. To understand the culture in which we live, you need to be familiar with the ideas that have shaped it. Today's lecture about modern philosophers is the final installment from a 35-part series by Dr. Sproul entitled Consequences of Ideas. In this overview series, Dr. Sproul traces the contours of Western philosophy throughout history and shows how our culture evolved to what it is today. From ancient Greek thinkers like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, to Christian philosophers such as Augustine, Anselm, and Aquinas, to the shapers of modern thought such as Hume, Kant, and Nietzsche, R.C. demonstrates the consequences of each of these and other important thinkers' ideas on world events, theology, the fine arts, and culture, as well as our everyday lives. This entire 35-part series is available on 12 CDs, normally priced at $74, but right now it's available for $59.20 plus shipping. To order your copy of Consequences of Ideas, call one of our resource consultants using our toll-free number, 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 1-800-435-4343. You can also log on to our website at ligonier.org. That's ligonier.org. That'll bring a close to this weekend edition of Renewing Your Mind. Thank you for listening. Join us again next weekend as Dr. Sproul leads us through a study of the Book of James. Please remember that prayerful and financial support for Renewing Your Mind Weekend Edition comes from listeners just like you in your radio listening area.